Hello, I'm Andrew Fuller. I'm a clinical psychologist and work with children, teenagers, and their families, particularly in the areas of resilience, learning strengths, and well-being. I'm also the chairperson of Generation Next. And in this series of podcasts, I'll be speaking with people who are experts in their area in terms of mental health and well-being. Thank you for joining us, and thank you for being part of the Generation Next podcast group. Thank you.
Today, I'm very privileged to discuss resistant depression and suicidal actions and thoughts with Dr. David Haugen, who's the Associate Professor of Clinical Psychiatry at University of Melbourne and specialises in resistant depression and suicidal behaviours. And today, what we're going to cover are some issues around young people and their sense of meaning in these difficult times, the spectrum of kind of suicidal thinking from really stress right through to feeling like you need to act on those thoughts, self-harm, and then, of course, some resources for young people and their families. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much, Andrew, and welcome to our audience. Let me give you a quick summary of what I'm hoping to cover in this podcast. So I want to get you to talk perhaps to young people about how badly stressed they are, because that's an acceptable question to ask on a 0 to 10 scale, perhaps. Go on to ask them perhaps about anxiety, depression, and indeed a particular concept I think is very useful is to ask people how much emotional pain are they in on a 0 to 10 scale. I then want to talk to you about how to ask about suicidal thinking. I will go on and list a number of free services, including a brand new one, IEEE.org.au. This is something that the Australian Suicide Prevention Foundation has come up with as a world first initiative. And it's a way of giving family and friends a tool they can access immediately if someone mentions wishing they were dead. And indeed, what do you do at 10 o'clock on a Friday night or a Saturday night when your son, daughter, or some other young person says, I wish I was dead, or I've been thinking of doing something to myself? So that will be the outline of the late podcast.
So let's start, David, with talking about, I guess there seems to be a sense with the difficulties, of course, of recent times of young people and just a loss of meaning in terms of the worthwhileness of life, really. Your thoughts on that?
It's an interesting question as to why do we stay alive? And we stay alive basically because the emotional positives of life exceed the stresses of life. And when that balance goes wrong, we get a whole range of things ranging from what we call the burnout syndrome, where it all seems pointless, to actually being pushed into overt psychiatric illness with depression, persuading people to die. And one of the things that's useful seeing a young person is to think about how humans develop. And we all know about Freudian theory, but in fact, Erik Erikson, E-R-I-C-S-O-N, wrote a chapter in a book many years ago called The Eight Ages of Man. And this is a very common sense summary of human development, whereby it talks about humans going through various growth stages emotionally. And that dictates many aspects of their personality and their functioning when they are adults. So for example, he would say that if a baby is looked after well in the first 18 months of life, then that baby grows up to be an adult with a sense of what he calls basic trust, which translates into a sense of optimism or a sense of competence that I can deal with problems when they come along. And if the child has been very disrupted in those first 18 months, they may not have those assets. In primary school, a particular issue is what we call industry versus inferiority, whereby if children get praised for the effort they put in and for the work they do, then that makes a big difference to their sense of self-sufficiency and self-pride as adults. Whereas if the praise is reserved only for those who come top of the class, the rest of the children don't get any positive input, which is what everybody needs. With the age group we're talking about here, I suppose we're particularly concerned about people in high school. And this is where what Erik Erikson talks about being the phase of identity versus role confusion. So phrased differently, young people desperately spend their high school years getting a sense of identity, acceptance, and the rules of society, so to speak, from interactions with their peers. And that's a particular problem in the pandemic, of course, where this group are cut off from each other, either by not being able to go to school or not being allowed to socialize together, which is a fundamental and basic need at this stage of their life.
Thanks. That's a really interesting way of introduction into this sort of thinking about loss of identity and confusion in your life, I think. Now, David, you've spoken and written, I think, about the spectrum of ideas, really, in terms of suicidal thinking. Can you tell us a bit about that?
All right. Stress is a normal part of life. We all have various pressures, and we either deal with them or we don't deal with them. And depending on the success of that, we get pushed onto a spectrum. If we can resist the stress, and there are books such as Learned Optimism, which tell people to problem solve rather than panic and worry, but also then people do get under stress, or if the stresses are just too much to cope with, they get pushed into being anxious. As the symptoms intensify, they may go down the scale or the spectrum and get depressed. And then some people go on to develop ideas of wishing they weren't alive, or more seriously, strongly thinking about doing something to themselves. And it is quite a problem in our society. Surveys indicate that about 25% of young people meet the criteria for anxiety or depression. So it really is a very important issue. None of us is invulnerable. We all have a breaking point. And if you put more pressures on people and you remove their protective resources, then they deteriorate. Now, certain things make people more vulnerable. And if I was to list four of them, I would say being a worrying or uptight or anxious person makes people more vulnerable under stress. Secondly, low self-confidence or self-esteem. Thirdly, perfectionism gives people such a huge workload in life that they get very stressed. And fourthly, lack of assertiveness, which perhaps overlaps with lack of self-confidence, where people find it difficult to express their opinion, makes them feel helpless and therefore vulnerable. And I actually have written a website where a number of these things are talked about as papers you can print, called doctorshealth.com.au. So if you want to, you can look at those concepts as they're written on that website rather than spending a lot of time on it. Let me start therefore. We go from stress to anxiety. So let me go down the scale a bit. So anxiety is something we all know about doing exams, and a certain amount of anxiety actually improves our performance physically and mentally. But at an increased level of anxiety, we start to get paralyzed by anxiety. So it is worth asking someone, a young person you're concerned about, on a 0 to 10 scale, let's say where 10 is panic, what is your anxiety running at? And it gives you some thumbnail sketch of what you're dealing with. Now, there are a number of also services and techniques that can be used for mild to medium levels of anxiety and depression. And so I might mention a few free services that are on the internet. So first of all, people can look up, say, relaxation techniques or progressive muscle relaxation. And the idea being that if you relax your body, the mind will relax to a certain extent. There is an app I've been told about called Balance, which is free till the end of this year. And it really is what is called guided meditation. So ways of helping people to relax. This will appeal to some people, it won't appeal to others. Some people prefer to use their logic and intelligence to try and fight off what the emotions are telling them. And there are two of those services. One is Mood Gym from the Australian National University. And the other is a website called thiswayup.org, run by St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney. And it gives multiple free courses on a whole range of symptoms of anxiety, depression, obsessive compulsive disorder, sleep problems, a whole range of things. There are some other sites like a Dr. Mary Kaspar with a K.com.au talks about the issues of raising girls in particular. And we all know about Steve Biddulph, who's written books about raising young people and particularly boys.
So one of the things I guess also that we need to think about in these times is self-harm and young people, David. And how does that interrelate with the stress spectrum?
Yes, that's a very important and very common problem. It's hard to believe, but all over the Western world, it seems that 10% of teenagers are self-harming. And that ranges from scratches on their skin to cuts on their skin, or burns, or hitting themselves, or banging their head. Really very distressing, and watching a young person doing this is very distressing. And the theory is that the most common reason young people do this is to try to get relief from their state of mind and how terrible they feel. Sometimes they do it to punish themselves, or to show other people how desperate they are. Sometimes then going down the list of frequency as to why people do it, this, people, teenagers report doing it to find out if they are loved, or they do it almost as a form of revenge and occasionally as a desperate way to get attention. In terms of the more serious things we may progressively move on to talk about, self-harm and self-cutting and so on is lowering the bar and predisposing people and desensitizing them to suicide, while only a tiny minority of people who cut themselves will end up dying from suicide. Phrased differently, 50% of people who have died from suicide have self-harmed.
Obviously, we live in a time of heightened concern about our young people. So I guess two intertwined questions. One is, what does a family member do at 10 p.m. on a Saturday night if a young person says, I don't feel that life is worth continuing on with? And I guess that probably logically interlinks with the level of services that are available.
Perhaps I might lead into that by talking first about the huge prevalence of depression. And it typically, 9 times out of 10, in effect, it might be said, it is depression that drives people to want to see life as not worth living, because depression blocks out any positives in life. So all the person sees are negatives, and the negatives get magnified. So we may have read about the standard symptoms of depression, and a low mood, or feeling tired, or not talking, or not texting their friends, not motivated, maybe even being tearful. But the one question I think is that's particularly zeroes in on something going wrong is ask the person, can they concentrate? In other words, if they're watching a TV show, can they remember what they see automatically? If they are reading an article or a book or a magazine or whatever, can they remember what they have read? If they used to be able to remember and can't, something is very wrong. If they've never been able to remember, you may worry. If they have ADHD, but if they used to be able to remember what they read and now they can't and they can't persevere, it may well be that they are getting pushed into depression, and perhaps they need to go and do some rating scales on Beyond Blue or something like that and see, do they meet the criteria for depression?
Sorry to interrupt you, David, but why is it that question that highlights to you a heightened concern?
That's a good point, Andrew. I have been doing this for very many years. It's always mentioned in the diagnostic criteria for depression. When I ask my colleagues, when does depression start or when does it end? there's no research guidance on this question, but from years of experience and treating literally thousands of patients with depression over the years, I have come to the very strong opinion, not yet proven by research, that the ability to concentrate is one of the first symptoms that slides away, and it's one of the last symptoms to return. So people may say, I can't even follow a conversation, then, okay, I can follow a conversation, but not then TV, then I can read a short article, and then after a while, yes, I can read a textbook or whatever and remember. And so that is my strong clinical opinion. I take your point that it is not proven yet by research, but I think it's a very useful screening question.
Yeah,
and if people say, in certain situations, however, I'm fine, I'm completely my normal self, then they are not describing depression as an illness, in my opinion. They are describing unhappiness. Unhappiness comes and goes. Depression is always there, even if it's pushed into the background when they're with friends. And quite apart from the formal list of symptoms of depression, it's important, if you're going to understand depression in young people or in anybody, to understand what depression is hammering into the person's mind 24/7. So depression is saying things like, you are alone, no one understands, no one can help, the pain will never stop, you are a burden, and people will be better off without you, you are worthless. So faced with that message being hammered into them, without them being aware that there's something going wrong, it's almost like having a computer virus taking over your brain. And then given those messages, it's no wonder people start to think, is life worth living? So it's worth saying to people, are things so bad you wish you didn't wake up in the morning? And if they say yes to that, just to clarify, do you actually wish you were dead? So that's what we call passive suicidal ideas. If people say yes to those questions, then you have to ask about active suicidal ideas. And so you would say, have you thought of doing something to yourself? And on a 0 to 10 scale, how strong are those thoughts? And then you may go on to other issues, like have they made plans or preparations or been close to doing something? Have they actually been looking on the internet about how it's done? And have they actually done something? Occasionally you will come across people who have done something and woke up next morning and are perhaps quite often either glad to be alive, sometimes disappointed to be alive. When I'm talking to doctors about this sort of thing, I'd say that the approach to suicide prevention is what I call have a heart. A is for analgesia. Analgesia is medical jargon for do something about the emotional pain. And then the heart bit is hope, empathy. Saying to a person who's suicidal, I understand this is very painful, I'm sorry. And for example, there was a Dr. John Horden, who was a previous president of the College of GPs in Britain, who said that the pain of depression that he had was worse than the pain he had from a kidney stone or from a heart attack. So it's a very painful and prolonged condition. We talk about antidepressants, but that's more of an issue to be talked about by professionals. Reassurance, reassuring a suicidal person, a depressed person, that they will recover is very important, because the illness is continuously telling them the opposite. And T is for texts, which is something I would like to lead on to.
Yes, so tell us a little bit about the resources that are available, David. That would be great.
Okay, well, of course, there are some very good services. Lifeline, lots of counseling services, and indeed on our new website in toughtimestext.org, we have all the lists of the Australian crisis services that people can access. The problem being, as we all know, young people, especially males, are very reluctant perhaps to engage with anybody to talk about emotional issues. So that is a problem. And also many of these services are engaged, not available, or have long waiting times on the telephone. And even if you can't go to an emergency department because at 10 o'clock on a Saturday night, there'll just be a 4-hour waiting list or whatever. So the reality is there are never going to be enough professionals or volunteers available. And what happens while you're waiting to see one of these people, or you see them for one visit and then you wait a week perhaps for the next visit, and a lot of these crisis situations arise outside normal business hours. There are 168 hours in the week. 40 of those hours are 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, leaving aside public holidays, etc. And most suicide attempts take place outside business hours. So what can you do? And we in the Australian Suicide Prevention Foundation have come up with a new concept. There are 3 steps fundamentally in people becoming suicidal. First of all, emotional pain, and secondly, hopelessness. We've talked about them, and they combine together to make people tempted to suicide. The thing that offsets that or doesn't offset it is whether or not the person has what we call connections or connectedness. So connections with other human beings are highly protective. Not having connections with other human beings makes people highly vulnerable once they are having these issues. So in tough times, text actually is a way of telling you how you can improve connectedness, how you can connect with this person, because the classic response by any of us when someone says, "I wish I was dead," is, "I'm afraid to say anything in case I say the wrong thing." So we are providing literally hundreds of medically approved text messages. And the feature of this website also is not only the approved text messages, which can be sent as texts or as WhatsApp messages so that there's a network supporting the suicidal person, but also all you have to do is hover over one of our texts and it immediately downloads onto your telephone. And then you can modify the message if you like, but you send the message from your phone to your son, your daughter, your friend, your family member, whoever it is. And you can either say these things if you are having that sort of relationship with the person, or you can send them as messages. The website is divided into what to ask, what to say, what to do, and what we call connecting until recovery. We also have this summary of the crisis services available by other organizations who would do very good work in this area, and how I recovered, being some survivor stories. I might just, before we finish, summarize some of the things that are on the website. So under what you can ask, there are things that you might send a text, for example, saying, "I noticed that you haven't been yourself. Is there anything I can do to help? Or would you describe the way you feel as okay, bad, or terrible? Or things sound really tough for you at the moment. Have things got so bad you just want to go to bed and not wake up?" So these are one of dozens of things you could say asking. What do you say to someone who then says, "I want to die"? And one of the themes that our service has been depending on for many years is the phrase, "You would never advise a friend to die. Tell yourself what you would tell a friend." I think that's a very telling message. We are all very good at giving advice to other people. We would never advise a friend of ours with problems to kill himself or herself. So why are we telling ourselves that that's the solution? And then it's also reminding the person that they are not alone, that there are professionals. And say, for example, we would say depression is very common under stress and it can be fixed. Or having suicidal thoughts is like having any other medical problem. If you've got mild asthma, you'd try treating it yourself. But if it's a life-threatening attack, you would ask the experts for help. And that's perhaps a very useful analogy. And then under what you can do, we suggest things like, "I will text you as often as is needed until you're safe and feel okay." Because suicidal ideas may be sudden and impulsive when a disaster happens in a young person's life. A relationship breaks down, they get into a terrible argument with someone, they feel totally rejected in some way. But in other people, if it is due to depression, then it goes on for a long time. So saying we are going to persevere is very good. We also say it would be really good if you could speak to your GP or another mental health professional. I can set up an appointment and go with you. And sometimes you might say to somebody, will you promise me that you won't harm yourself until we talk or message again? That's a standard promise we all ask. One of the twists we add to that is, how strongly can you promise? Is this a really strong, dependable promise or a medium level promise, because I'm still torn by the depression and the distress telling me I want to die? So in summary, what IEEE.org.au or in toughtimestext.org does is it provides frequent personal anti-suicide messages from the most important people in the life of the suicidal person, and they enmesh the patient in persuasive and protective emotional bonds, which we hope will actually deter suicidal acts. Phrased more simply, we intensify connections, and that it makes it more difficult for people to ignore the connections and do something to themselves. We also describe it as, in effect, a community-driven safety net, allowing family and friends to support anyone who says they're suicidal immediately and before and in between visits to GPs or mental health services. So I hope that I have explained the concept and given people some practical steps that they can actually use as they deal with people at various points on the spectrum of stress, anxiety, depression, suicidal ideas.
Thank you, David. That's very, very helpful for people. I just want to thank you and honour the work that you do. It makes such a difference for so many people and so many families and so many other professionals. And I just want to honour that work as it's been no doubt your lifelong mission to create some of these wonderful resources for us all. And thank you.
Okay, I treat people as if they were my own family. So I think, what would my family want if they were in trouble? Could I ask the audience a favor, which is, we don't need your money, we need publicity. So could you please just publicize this service and write to us if you would like flyers to distribute or download a flyer from the website.
And where would they write to you or contact you?
The address is on it, but admin@aspf.org.au.
Thank you so much, and thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you would like to follow up in further detail, please listen in to some of the other podcasts that we have made, which are available through the Generation Next website. There are also a series of books from Generation Next in terms of nurturing young minds, covering a series of issues to do with young people, and also in my own book, Tricky Behaviors, and Your Best Life at Any Age, which are both available either on Amazon or through Bad Apple Press. Thank you so much, and I hope to connect with you again soon. Thank you.